All right. If you missed it last episode, for our 50th episode anniversary, here we are doing a giveaway of the Anarchy Agile hats. Those are go to the link if you want to see what they look like. But all you need to do is sign up for my newsletter, Skill Issue, which comes out mostly every week via the special URL. You'll find it in the show description, but I'll say it out loud here. It is jardo.dev/anarchyagile. So go check it out. You have to use that link. Even if you are already subscribed, just go there and put your email in and it will update. It'll tag your account so that you will be eligible to get a free hat. They just say Agile on them, but the A is like an anarchy A. So check it out. Welcome to Dead Code. I'm Jared. And today we're talking to Justin Searles. Let's get into it.
Justin, welcome to Dead Code.
Thanks for having me. The best code is dead code. And, I think listening to a few of your episodes, I'm really excited to be here. So thanks a lot. I'm honored and privileged and so forth.
Awesome. So besides someone who has written too many mocking frameworks, who are you?
Well, that's a great question. I've been various people over the past 20-ish years, 20-plus years of being like a programmer, whether as a student and then 2011, co-founded a consultancy, which is like pretty visible in the Ruby community, called Test Double, which is a reference to mocking, but also like has the nice, you know, handy attribute that like even if somebody knows nothing about testing, it sounds like a good idea that they do it two times. So we're a consultancy of about like 100 people. In more recent years, in the last couple of years, the company just reached a point in the scale where I wasn't that operationally useful. So while I'm still a board member, I'm mostly focused on solo endeavors right now. So you can follow along and my, you know, progress in trying to live the best life I can as a man of leisure who has a bad software programming habit, at justin.searles.co. And then I've got my own podcast, which is, a solo 3-hour drive time radio sort of exploration of everything going on in my life, just trying to make friends with a slowly growing audience, and that's called Breaking Change.
Yeah, I've listened to that a little bit, and yeah, it's quite enjoyable.
It's quite an acquired taste, I hear.
Yeah, I will say the length of it was I have to find time, but I surf, and the surf spots near me are like an hour and a half drive away. So that's a good solid Breaking Change episode right there. So we had a little exchange on our respective blogs the other day. I posted about how different programming techniques and approaches and the order at which you tackle the problems that you're trying to solve has significant effects on the kinds of solutions that you arrive to. And you then picked that up and ran with it in an interesting direction. What about my post initially sort of piqued your interest?
Well, I think that we often talk about code and architecture and patterns and dependencies and packages. Like, just look at all these names and words that we have for it as a static, inert thing that exists. But code means nothing except for its execution. You know, code, in terms of its impact on the world, is constantly in motion. And that's why when I've had an opportunity to get on a big stage or really try to push somebody on in terms of how they think about how they work and their approach, is I think about workflow. I think about what are the thinky thoughts you're having in your brain, in what order, and with what tempo. And the conversation, like, you know, test-driven development, right? It's like, it's not that we have these tests and we have this code of these tests. The breakthrough was actually what's driving my next action, right? So like Jay Fields had a post, I think it was Jay, a long, long time ago, 2008, 2009. And he said, you know, the thing about test-driven development is it's not about like red, green refactor. It's not like you write a failing test and then you write a passing test. It's you write a test that gives you like the failure message that you want, and then you change the production code. And the goal isn't just to make the test go green, because that might be too much. It's to either make the test pass or change the message. And you see glimmers of the same thing from different communities, like people who are sort of like growing types, like they're growing some sort of fungal colony to understand and grope around the different models that they got. Or you might see in like the like a Lispy community like Enclosure, people would really live in the REPL or in Scratchpad files.
Yeah.
That whole area of like the coding as work, that is a process that we go through, and it's an interactive one between us and the computer. I find that so much less explored than like the sort of static retrospective, and here's what all the code is, that whenever I see anyone else kind of singing from the same songbook like you did in terms of the order in which we tackle these problems has design implications, you should think about that. So I was immediately subscribed.
Yeah, and there's a the idea I was getting at for anyone that didn't actually get into the article is that there's sometimes we're explicit about what we're considering as we head into a problem, and I've seen I always really liked, I was watching a stream of John Hawthorne's where he was I don't even remember what he was working on, but he was pairing with someone and the other person wanted to. Was worried about something about the end implementation, and John was like, I'm not ready to think about that right now. And that's great. That tells me that he's thinking explicitly about, okay, what am I going to think about now? Which is, I think, an underdeveloped skill for a lot of people. But the actual, whether you're doing TDD or any of the other approaches you described, there's a ton of sort of implicit, what are you going to be faced with and therefore think about in those approaches as well?
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, I think the John's a very deliberative guy. Like I've seen him at a bunch of conferences, and it might've been the stream he did with Aaron Patterson. I don't know, but like I remember so many times where I'd ask a question, and he would just sit and think for a long time and I might get the answer the next day. So, you know, if you'd asked him, what do you want for lunch at 10 a.m.? He's like, I'm not ready to think about that right now, would probably be a just characteristic reply. And honestly, I think that's actually, that sort of mental discipline is really rare and under-celebrated. And I don't think we learn anything in school, and we don't get the kind of like, no one at your performance review is like, hey, way to like ignore all the things that don't matter. That really stood out. But I think we underrate just how much, a lot of programmers are type A. We're like, worry warts. We're all the Yagni, all the future proofing, all of the kind of like turf hoarding and stuff. It's a lot of fears of the future. And when you think about when you're trying to get something that just works, and you allow your consciousness to get poisoned by all the worry of like, well, what am I going to need a week from now or a month or the pull request review and stuff, it can inhibit your ability to like clear the very next hurdle in front of you.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the connections you made in your response was about becoming a what you called a full breadth developer.
Yeah.
Could you maybe explain what that term means to you?
I try not to get in the business of like coining terms that I hope other people pick up and run with, because it's a low probability of success. But the full stack developer meme had a lot of cachet, and it lasted for a long time. And it pointed out a cleavage that I think was like really valuable. Like whether you think it was whatever happened to that term in terms of recruiters and all this stuff, like I think it really helped point out, like, do you believe that programmers should have this very hyper specialization around depth in one area? I am a front end developer, and I get the specs from the guy who does the controllers, and then like, I implement the front end, and then the controller guy, I never actually talked to the model guy, the controller guy talks to him, and you see that as a kind of pattern. And so it's a kind of shibboleth for, like, you know, are you an organization where everyone just kind of like, is they're all just ass kickers and they all get everything done independently? And yeah, that means that, like, there's not maybe as much consistency in process. Or are you somebody who's more, you know, familiar and comfortable with, like, having a kind of regimented or compartmentalized organization or process? When I said full breadth developer, what I'm thinking about there is not just the internal architecture of systems or the individual specialities or tasks as a developer. Setting aside that, it's really like the developer, you know, the old Office Space, the overplayed meme of, like, you know, like, I'm the guy who takes the specifications from the customer and hands it to the engineers. The idea that, like, product people are different people than programmer people is an artifice of a lot of things, but in part, large enterprises, VC-backed startups with non-technical founders who need their egos stroked, and the kind of breakdown of institutional, you know, vision-driving decision-making in organizations, leading to, well, we got to have somebody as, like, the decider of this stuff to steer the engineering organization. And because we can't communicate well with them or trust them, we're going to get some business analyst or something. And so if you see Scrum and all of the different agile methodologies, the way that they joined product and software was typically a product owner or equivalent role. And for the time when you still needed 12 people to kind of put together a working application and a cross-functional team, like, that was itself revolutionary, right? Because those were previously departments. Mm-hmm. Now we're entering an era where, like, a single developer with a single Claude code terminal can spin up 12 parallel, you know, sub agents and get so much done so quickly that the communication bottleneck, not just between me and my product owner, like, is so much that is so inhibitive, to have the product decisions, like, who, you know, to outsource the idea, like, what's a good tasteful way to, like, make this UI work, or how should this button behave, or what does the user really want here, to, like, you know, delegate accountability for understanding, like, what are we solving for as the programmer. You could get away with that for a long, long time because that's what the product guy was for. I'm just doing one Jira ticket today. If I have to sync up for 30 minutes, that's fine. But if you 10x that productivity, now you are the person who should be making these decisions, because that single phone call or that single email is going to, you're going to lose, like, so many possible cycles. So a full breadth developer, realize this is why we make pithy little three word phrases, because it takes a while to explain. Full breadth developer is somebody who just views it as part of their job to like understand a problem, map it to a product, have the vision, own that, and have the accountability to, like, make those decisions in the course of their development. Just like a test-driven developer would take in tests, or a DevOps developer would take in operations. It's just another responsibility that becomes part of the creator's, you know, job.
Yeah, it's an interesting term because, you know, I run a consultancy as well, and when I'm talking to clients, I basically had to describe what you just described to them, and have ended up using different words. I think the most common one is that I describe our developers as whole ass members of the team. They are there to figure out what work needs to get done, talk to whoever they need to talk to figure out what that is, it fully integrate into the organization, and then take, you know, everything they figure out back and build things, show them off, and do that largely without the intervention of specific product people or even PMs or anything. And that sort of brings you back to sort of an interesting comment on how you frame things, which is, you mentioned these agile methodologies, and they came out of the same era roughly as things like extreme programming, XP did. And XP didn't necessarily have those separations. When a lot of these ideas come up, you get the OG XP people screaming at their screens, being like, we've been doing this the whole time. We've been talking to the customer the whole time. What are your thoughts on why that sort of view of the world, you know, didn't become dominant, even though it was concurrent with things like Scrum?
I've got like deer in the headlights face at you right now, because I'm thinking back to my paperback copy of Kent Beck's Extreme Programming Explained and being like, I swear to God, there was a product owner in that. And if there wasn't, then it's just a serious Mandela effect on my part. And I'm like, oh man,
isn't the expectation that programmers are interacting directly with business people in that?
Yeah, I guess it's without calling it up right now, I encourage somebody to pause and then they can be right and one of us or both of us can be wrong to go look this up. But I think so. Like I was actually on a project in 2010. So just fun historical fact, like the extreme programming to a large extent was developed as part of the 3Cs project at Chrysler to develop what I think was like a time tracking kind of system for internal billing for budgeting purposes. And in the Detroit area, like a few years after that, I was working at a consultancy called Pillar, who had many, many second degree connections with folks like, you know, Ron Jeffries. And a lot of those Agile manifesto signatories would just like show up at my office at my desk, you know, sometimes with commentary about a lot of this stuff. And when you got to actually meet them and see them, or whether it was at one of the Agile conferences or something, regardless of what the book said, these were people who took it upon themselves to actually connect the dots from need to solution to understanding return on investment. And the particular kind of ideas that they had, or the processes or the workflows or the tools or the ideas or the blog posts that they cooked up, were all of a piece with that. None of them were meant to be gospel. It was just like, that's how they lived and breathed. And because of the buzz around Agile and by tying it together with extreme programming and sort of having this sort of generation of heroes all associated with it, I think we tend to it. In fact, what happens? The same thing that always fucking happens, like with Martin Fowler and his architectural patterns books, Atlassian patterns. Like all that stuff's really useful, except that if we're teaching people that these are the patterns or that this is the process, instead of, and this is my point and part of my response to your blog post, is like what we should be teaching is like how to think like they think to create their own structure as they go in a contextual way to meet the moment that they're in. Because I don't care what the perfect process is. If all I have is an order taker who follows processes, that's probably not what we actually need. And it would certainly be more valuable if you were coming up with and creating that process or that architecture or that question or that really insightful way to get the client thinking the way that they need to be thinking. And so outsourcing that responsibility to be like extreme programming is yet another artifact to follow as a disciple is kind of the problem.
Yeah, that's fair. So I think one of the questions I have to ask is, in these conversations that sporadically come up around, you know, these hard or these under discussed ideas of, you know, what does the nitty gritty of writing code, like how do we do it and how do we do it well? What do we think about? What's our process? How do we decide on these fine grained decisions? One of the trickiest things is that it's clear to anyone who talks about these things that they're underexplored, that there's a lot more to be said there. But it's really difficult to get to actual like concrete takeaways in those conversations. There's a lot of these conversations end up in very like, oh, well, it depends. Sometimes I think about this, sometimes I think about this. And intuition plays a big role in a lot of that. So I will pose to you the most concrete possible question, and let's see where we go. How do you personally decide what to work on when tackling a problem?
Oh, that's a good one.
Where do you start?
You zigged, and I thought you were going to zag. You're right. I mean, like, I can think of conferences I was at where it's like other thought leaders who thought lead the same thoughts that I lead. Like, we'd get into a room to have an argument about, like, you know, object-oriented programming or domain-driven design or whatever the hell. And the problem with those kinds of conversations, to get to your point, is like, we all have like a little philosophical palace in our mind, and we're comparing, like, you know, the curtains and drapes in ours versus the shape of the windows in theirs. And then there's no productive outlet for that kind of like astronaut architect meets other astronaut architect to describe thing in like some sort of metaphysical realm, because there's not the actual work, right? So getting down to the actual work, getting traction and figuring out, you know, like how do these metaphysical conceptual ideas map to like the actual act of doing the thing, that's so much more interesting to me. And so I kind of fell off like the conference circuit generally, but even sort of like even engaging in these kinds of discussions for the better part of a decade for exactly the reason that you said. So that was my attempt to dodge answering your question. I want to know, how do you think I did? Do you remember the question? Did I successfully make you forget what you asked?
Yeah, no, it was, my memory's too good. I did remember what I asked, but
damn it all to hell.
But you know, that's fair. And I think that's, you raise a good issue with why these conversations are hard, why these journeys tend to be mostly sort of self-reflective journeys. And they come out in pieces of advice frequently that are very reductive. Like the thing I put into my most recent blog post was that I choose TDD as my default way of working, and I think it's a good one. There's a ton that goes into why that is, from intuition, experience, etc. And it doesn't say anything about all of the situations where I would choose to do something else, which I think, you know, is probably where the more interesting conversations might be.
Yeah. And I think that's a completely, I know you don't do video for your show, but for anyone listening, he's not like wearing any sort of religious garb or anything like that. There's not like Jared doesn't have like a Pope hat on when he says, there's no special gesture when he says he practices TDD. So he's like maybe a born again test driven development disciple. But like, no, in all seriousness, to actually get back to the question that you first posed, what order do I do stuff in? I think that even if TDD were the answer to the folks listening to this podcast, because TDD is a defined thing that everyone kind of knows, that it's impossible to discern, is Jared saying that because he's on this team, or is Jared saying this because in motion, that's the thing that he's found that works best for him. And, you know, I know what you mean by that, but like, it doesn't necessarily give in the head of a viewer or a listener what we really mean. So I'll try to give an example of a way that's not a popular methodology for thinking about this.
Sure.
I am personally just kind of wired to be a worry wart, relatively like a high anxiety person. I tend to have a lot of, my wife Becky calls it chessboarding, where like, you know, like how naive chess algorithms will just see how many like number of boards can in whatever my time limit is, how many boards of chess can I hypothetically play out to understand which is the least bad move of all the moves that I can make. And my brain is just constantly doing that asynchronously. So I'm constantly just in risk analysis mode. It's just the way that my brain works. So one approach that I've taken to programming that has been really successful for me, given that way that my brain tends to work of just fear driven everything, is to, instead of view programming as you're building up little building blocks to create like, you know, some sort of castle or something, I think about it as there is a unknowable but large amount of risk and uncertainty and fear and doubt out there. So we don't know how much there is. We just know there's a lot, because at the start of any project it is at whatever its maximum is. And at the end of the project, it's at zero because we're not changing the code anymore, or we're calling it done enough. And so my workflow is find the thing that I feel is the riskiest or the scariest or is causing me the most worry and ennui, and pick that first. And once I've picked the thing, then I go through whatever process is appropriate. Maybe it's at a middle level of the stack, bottom of the stack, top of the stack. Maybe I should just go do a spike somewhere and like answer the question. And once I've, you know, my acid reflux has gone down, then at that point, I rather than just dive in and force an implementation necessarily, then I ask again, like, okay, so like now what am I most worried about? And it might, because right now I'm doing a lot of Swift and iOS for the first time, I'm kind of in like week three of things I'd always kind of been generally unsure and unclear about how they do it in iOS Xcode land. And I'm not actually building real product and combined system yet. It's taking me much longer to actually get that kind of traction, but I have to hold on and like actually address all these underlying concerns first, because the last thing I want to do is start building a bunch of stuff and it turns out that one of my assumptions was false all along.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's a It's an approach that I have definitely used. I use it heavily when it comes to prioritizing things at a project level. It's always seemed prudent. Okay, let's look at the things we're most worried about, the features we're not sure we know how to build and tackle those. But I've always used that at a
sort of at a macro level.
Yeah, at the micro level, I do use it sometimes, but only when I sort of as like a tiebreaker. Like if mm-hmm. I like, oh, you know, if I know what I want to do next and I have a good idea of it in my mind, usually I want to capitalize on like, oh, I think I know how I want to do this next bit. Since I know that right now, I want to do that. But if I'm not sure about, you know, where the implementation's going, I'll often use it as that sort of tiebreaker, which
I like you saying tiebreaker, by the way. I think that we could actually, let's say that the reducing the cone of uncertainty to zero is like my mental model for everything and it's my starting point. I think if we're trying to hold a discussion about what is your workflow, then mm-hmm. Think of it as a series of tiebreakers. Okay, all other things being equal, I've got two things that are equally scary. What's the next thing that I do? And for me, it might be the gravity or the permanence of the decision. So another iOS example is once you've created, if you're using the new Swift data and Cloud Kit, where basically you're just trusting Apple to host all of the user's data in a totally private way, which I want to do, even though it's like backed with a SQLite database locally, Apple doesn't let you just blow up the container of data. They want to protect people's data overall. They force you now to like, you know, migrate it somehow. And that has me a little bit skittish where it's like, yeah, I mean, I've got 20 years of Rails experience migrating data. I shouldn't be so worried about it. But it's got me thinking, okay, maybe I should spend a little bit more time thinking about this data model a little bit more clearly. Because as soon as I put something out to test flight, I am now kind of stuck with that, at least initially, or I have to migrate it away, you know, n number of times. Maybe that's my second decision point. And I can think of a third and fourth, but I'm curious how, maybe that'll help people understand everything as sort of like this game of Plinko. That's how your brain actually works when you're coding.
Yeah. And again, like that's something I've also considered. Again, it comes up at those macro levels, but then gets applied at the micro level as well. And I feel like that one is one where the sort of project state is heavily dependent on how much I pay attention to that. If I'm at the very beginning of a project, I'm usually critically aware that the decisions I'm making are potentially going to be very long-lived because future work will be built on them, and thus tend to spend more time thinking about any given decision even.
And it's, by the way, it's worse now with coding agents, because if you've only got five examples of like what code looks like in your app and they're all the wrong one, they're going to multiply. And that's why I literally RMRF'd my project a couple weeks ago for exactly that reason.
Yeah. The initial steps of greenfield projects are important even without the existence of coding agents, because, you know, I've seen, you know, human programmers do the same replicating patterns that were in a code base that probably shouldn't have been replicated. And the AI tools are very good at that.
Yeah. What's like another example of a kind of tiebreaker that you think of? And honestly, you're saying macro versus micro. Part of my whole full breadth developer shtick is like everything is micro now, like because things are moving so fast. If you're getting through 10, 20 tickets a day, like that's now your morning is macro in terms of thinking about how you're going to stack these things. Or if you're working with sub agents, like how am I going to divvy up this work? Just like if I was divvying up a team. So now that like micro is the day-to-day work stream, what other maybe if you're thinking about your project consultancy sales guy head, what other things bubble up to the surface now in terms of decision criteria?
I mean, one that I never feel like good around making decisions around it, but does end up factored in is the sort of the visibility of a given feature or piece of work. So I never like to have a sprint that's full of work that's really hard to like show that we did. I always want to be able to point to things and be like, here, look at the thing that was done. Sometimes it's unavoidable. We work with Solidus, which is an e-commerce Ruby on Rails framework engine. And sometimes, you know, the thing you did this week was you upgraded to the new version and you fixed all the incompatibilities. So there's no thing to point at. It's like, yeah, well, I can point at the fact, the nebulous fact that you're going to pass your PCI compliance because you're not using, you know, an end of life version of something.
Right. Or Testable did a bunch of we did a whole lot of, and still do, and are happy to, Ruby Rails upgrade projects like GitHub. We helped them get from, I think we joined at 4.0 to get them onto master with Rails. And those projects, we had the same question because me as a consultant guy is like, I know that our rate is expensive and we will get bopped on the head if we don't have something to show for our continued progress. And so fortunately, Eileen Uchitel was already in the chair running that project on the GitHub side and already had a really good way of visualizing this is how many test failures we have, or even before you got to the point where you could run the test, this is how many builds and scripts don't run at all yet. And then we'd inch up each week and be able to score wins that way, even though it wasn't visible to users. They were able to other stakeholders internally could at least see boxes getting checked.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one decision. I've definitely been in situations where it's I'd really love to have a couple more things to point at in the weekly meeting tomorrow. Let's do those things rather than, you know, maybe this other thing that technically should be more important, but keeping people happy and the organization happy, it does also matter.
Well, a translation of the micro for that for me as solo developer who is playing, a new game plus career right now as a wannabe iPhone app maker. I think there is value psychologically to me as a programmer to do the thing that I would find fun or self-satisfying. I want to see this liquid glass button fan out and radially and tap it again and see it kind of collapse in a nice animation. I know that's possible because I just saw the sample code do something like that or saw in a session. And right now I'm kind of tired because I've been futzing with and I'm exhausted fighting with Swift testing or Xcode build CLI and it's 3 p.m. and I just want to notch a win today so that I don't wake up tomorrow dragging my feet. And so maybe that's not the first way, first order way that I decide what to work on. But if it's, the third or the fourth or the fifth, there are probably worse things to do than to set yourself up for mentally being stimulated and excited about continuing.
Yeah, I find myself, I run a weekly programmer meetup here in Victoria, and I always like to give myself the first task of whatever I'm going to work on at the meetup. I give myself something extraordinarily achievable. So I can show up at the meetup, I can do the easy thing, and be like, I did the thing I set out to do today. Now I can work on something hard and make no progress all evening and end up just chatting with people. It's still a win. So even in my spare time, we find that kind of prioritization in there.
What about your staff? And I don't know how big your organization is, but when you're working with your developers who are ultimately working on client stuff, what kind of advice and what kind of how do you find yourself having to help steer their decision-making as they figure out what do I do next? Because that's maybe a little bit more micro because it's, internal to inside the house sort of calls.
Yeah. So we're about a 10-person team right now. And the biggest piece of advice I tend to give people is, our clients are primarily e-commerce organizations. And there's usually one person on the client side who is the person we talk to way more than anyone else. Somebody got tapped on the shoulder at the organization was like, you're in charge of the programmers. And, like I said, we do branch out and we try to talk to whoever we need to talk to, but there's one person who's in the hierarchy is in charge of the relationship with us. And the piece of advice I give our developers is do whatever you can to help that person be successful. Who that person is may change, but there's probably a person in that organization who you can support with your work. And that will make everything go smoothly. And That's been very successful, for us. If, that person comes to us with a problem and they're like, oh, some bad thing happened and we need to recover, gauge from them what the most important thing to be working on is and just go straight for that.
That's relatable, because when you're running the consultancy and you sold the deal, you've got skin in the game, right? Because you got to see the client when they were describing their hopes and dreams and fears about whatever the engagement is. And then, whoever is working on it might not, even if they were there on day one, by day 100, they're in it, right? And mm-hmm. they might need routine reminders to pull up and like think, hey, what our vision. I got to meet the managing director of Accenture in Chicago, like their biggest office, 5 or 6 years back. He was a fascinating guy and a massive consultancy, tens of thousands of people kind of like bubble up under him in some way or another. And we were having a conversation because it was me and 5 or 6 other kind of consultancy owners getting to pick his brain a little bit. And we were talking about this exact thing. It's like, how do you instill in people this ultimate, value of client delight? And to be thinking about that as like their North Star for decision making. And, this is really kitschy, but he said, even to this day at Accenture, and I assume this was like an Arthur Andersen thing before that, they have like, paid for by your clients, printed on every paycheck and pay stub, as just like a reminder of like, this is who we're here for, not for ourselves. And I think that's like really, really useful. And that kind of context, sometimes you just need another person to remind you of or tap you on the shoulder to kind of give you that perspective. But I think it's a useful kind of like pivot point to ask you, like, I think programmers, even the absence of sort of any monetary thing or you serving somebody else, like we very often, once we get our nose in the sand and we go down a rabbit hole, it's really, let's see if we get a third metaphor in here, like we can lose the forest for the trees and just lose sight of like the thing that like our actual end goal. And when that happens to you as a programmer, like, part of the process is moving forward and part of the process is knowing when to back up the car. What signals do you look for and how do you make the decision to course correct when maybe you're forcing something or just going down an unproductive path?
I don't know if I can point to specific signals. I tend to, my day is broken up naturally by the various things that come up running a business, as well as the human needs to eat, and various other things. And those moments when I sit back down to a piece of work tend to be when I decide, I'm wasting my time on this. I go for lunch and I come back and I go, I spent my whole morning on this. I still haven't got it working.
I don't want to be around anymore.
I could is it really worth it? Is it really worth my time to continue grinding on this thing? Or is there like something else I can do? Is there, could I go talk to someone and see if there's a simpler, behavior that might get us that might solve the same problem? Is there some sort of technical shortcut I can take? And I find it's those moments when I sit back down at a problem and I have to load it all up in my brain and I realize how much time I've already spent on it and reevaluate whether the path I'm on is the best one.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like you're rubber ducking with your past self. You're like, apparently I'm not able to explain what the hell I was doing in a sentence.
Yeah.
And so like you layer on more and more. It's like, this guy doesn't know what he's doing at all. Like now that you're looking, I like that. One that I do is sometimes time feels like, when you're in your head and when you're working solo on something, sometimes the time of day moves very quickly and sometimes it moves very slowly. And one isn't good and one isn't bad, but I've become mindful of when time seems to be moving really quickly for me, it's either a sign that like I'm really flying and just getting so much shit done. I feel like you got to hold me back because I'm just like, I know exactly where I'm going. And then there are times when it means like I am stuck and I'm just spinning my tires and I'm getting exhausted and frustrated. And so rather than listen for like emotional or kind of physiological cues, although that can also be useful, if I look up at the clock and it's like further ahead than I think, it's an opportunity for me to pause and be like, is this time going faster for good or bad reasons? And I'll do the same thing you do and say, you know what? Let's maybe I take up, I do take that break at that point, and I come back and I try a different tack later.
Yeah. Yeah. I think another sort of trigger that leads to those kinds of decisions is, you know, we've all heard of rubber ducking. When I'm like really stuck on something and I go to ask about it, we have like a help channel that's just, you can ask any kind of question you want in there in our Slack. And I'm like most of the way typing through the message, you have that moment where you're thinking like, what are the people who are going to read this going to think? And sometimes that's the moment where I realize someone is going to be like, Jared, why are you even doing this? Why aren't you doing this other thing? And it's not just for the sort of programming puzzles. It's also for this sort of, change of approach, higher level pivots that kind of moments are useful.
Man, I find myself having the same issue just this week. I wrote a post about using the new Apple Foundation models and like using dynamic schemas to generate relatively dynamic result objects. And how, because it's not well documented currently. And the reason I wrote that post was I was really just in over my skis because I had some of their APIs combined with some of my very novice Swift constructions all blended together. And I wasn't able to get an observable answer in a clear way. And so I was just frustrated and nothing else was helping. And so I go to this Slack that I'm in of other iOS developers, and they're all like, wow, that sounds really interesting and hard. Like, do you have an example that I can look at? And I looked at my code and be like, well, this isn't what I should be doing. And I start a standalone Swift file with a little playground at the end that like, you know, does the thing. And it, wouldn't you know it, but like actually having to code just the problem in isolation, I was able to demonstrate the problem. And then I was able to think for 30 seconds and be like, oh, here's a creative solution to that one. And then that one and that one and all three of the issues that I'd raised earlier, I was able to solve myself. Right. But like for some reason, something about me is like, it's a blind spot that I just, dropping down to a standalone script, I don't know what it is. You know, so sometimes I'll be able to identify in a test if I've got the right seam or the right API. Mm-hmm. But like when I'm pairing with Aaron Patterson, he will just so quickly drop down to just like a throwaway Ruby script and start writing out like a repro of like whatever we're seeing. And I'll look at him and he's got a great post called I'm a puts debuggerer. And he uses puts instead of interactive things like pry or binding.irb. And whenever I'm pairing with Aaron, I'm like, man, I got to pick up this habit. I got to like change this orientation. And I've so far struggled, although this conversation might be a good kick in the ass. I'm kind of curious for you in your process, what do you see as being perpetual hangups or in terms of how you approach your work and how you order it, things where maybe you might want to take a second look at how you work?
I know that there are like techniques that require too much. Like I don't reach for them soon enough, and I don't really, like, you know, having not seriously considered why until this moment, I'm not sure I have an answer as to why. But for example, I know that profiling a piece of code is really easy, but like it takes me actually having to there being a serious performance issue before I will actually go pull out my profiler. I know how to do it. I've done it. I know it takes 2 seconds to set up a reasonable test. But for some reason, for me, it's like, that's just like a thing that for some reason my brain doesn't want to do. I'd rather do like anything other than profiling work. And I enjoy it once I get into it too. But that's something that probably could be better at.
Well, if you don't mind like lying down in your Freudian leather couch behind you, which I can just make up props for you because we're not doing the video of this. I have a couple ideas of why you might be that way. One is friction, like the friction of whatever that 2 seconds of setup supposedly is to actually profile the thing of like, you know, maybe rebooting the server with instrumentation turned on or whatever that is, or creating a new file or switching over to a different tool. I think all of those could contribute. But another one that happens a lot, I think, with highly productive programmers, especially if you're experienced, is anything that isn't materially moving the ball forward in terms of the actual like work product itself, that is the code, feels like failure. It's like any minute that I spend profiling the thing instead of just like, I don't know, magically knowing how to tune this Postgres query and making it better is a waste. And if I spend 10 times as long just staring at like the Ruby layer and squinting and hoping to find it, at the end of the day, I won't look back and be like, well, that was a waste instead I'll just say, well, that was work. And then eventually, yeah, I did find out that I had to go and, like, you know, pull up PG Hero or PG Muscle and do the analyze step of the Postgres query. And for whatever reason, I can be that way sometimes. And I'm overly forgiving with, like, my past self for spending way too long staring at the wrong thing when I did have the tools at my disposal to actually get an answer to the question of, like, why is this slow?
Yeah. Yeah. Perhaps that's it. I mean, I don't know. I really enjoy doing performance work, though. I just, like, it doesn't, it feels, I like being able to come back and be like, I made this 100 times faster. We had one of our developers do that, made something. I'm not sure what it was. They were doing their Black Friday prep and they were like, oh, we found something, you know, tremendously bad in the code. And we literally made some response in the, that was part of the regular checkout flow, like 100 times faster. And like, I love delivering that news. I love the puzzle of working on it. So maybe the problem is I like it too much and I know I'll just get stuck in performance work for too long because it's one of those never ending holes, you know? You can keep making something faster forever.
I think that there's been in the past a sort of penalty or a tax that is paid by people who check the blind spots, who handle the cross-cutting concerns really well. Like, naming the company Test Double was the least bad option of extremely hilariously bad options as Todd Kaufman and I were batting around ideas. And as soon as I kind of like came to it, I was like, oh, this operates at two or three levels. You know, I've got a lot of experience in testing and outside in, back to your post about what order do you do stuff in, outside in London school test-driven development. And so, like, the people that we know will see it as a wink right away, and we'll get some traction with that. But the flip side of that was, because I was the guy in 2011 who was, or 2010, that was doing JavaScript testing, like unit testing in JavaScript religiously, because I talked about it a lot, because I'd written a Ruby mocking framework at that point, because I was writing blog posts about good test design. A non-zero number of clients would come to us and say, oh, I assumed you were a QA firm, right? Or they would deploy us to their project where ostensibly we're supposed to be people on the team, or I am. And it's like, oh, well, funny that like we're just getting all of the cucumber work and none of the actual building the thing work. And like, it's not particularly edifying or enriching work. I'm kind of curious from your perspective, right? Like, today in the era of Claude Code, I feel like being super well-rounded and being able to answer all these questions and having this context is hugely valuable. But it, just 10 years ago, where there was more specialization and people were typically kind of like stereotyped or pigeonholed into a particular area, I'm kind of curious, like, what your experience with that was and whether you've seen that change too.
I mean, being that, you know, we are specialists in a specific framework, and that I've been specializing in this framework for like over 10 years now, it does sort of lend, like, people have very clear expectations of where we're coming from and how we fit into the team and what our job is. And that sort of, you know, they appreciate the sort of broader breadth of knowledge from us, but they are definitely looking for, you know, our team members as individuals, but also us as an organization, to provide them with sort of the knowledge and experience of having worked with this framework for so long. So that always sort of colors that sort of interaction for us.
They're interested in your feedback to a point, but there's a certain subtextual, like, stay in your lane. You're the guy who's the Solidus expert here. And I'm sure that you've got really, really collaborative relationships with current and past clients where you've expanded way beyond the scope of like just being the Solidus people. I'm kind of curious, actually, because, you know, having had similar experiences in the past, even if you're a general purpose consultancy, just so you know, this happens all the time because you're brought in to solve problem one. And Jerry Weinberg and the Secrets to Consulting, a great book and kind of sort of the way to think about it, is like, you're there to solve the client's problem, but then, like, once you do, you gotta figure out, you know, either get out of there or help them identify and find the next problem to be solving. I'm kind of curious what what you have done to break out of it when you have been sort of pigeonholed. Because after I wrote that full breadth developers post, I got a lot of email, but I got quite a few people who are like, I am in this very specific role, sir, and I would love to break out and start to provide value to my company in other ways, but everyone thinks of me like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I think the fact that we push to create those connections with the various parts of the company really helps us become valuable in new ways and find new sort of avenues for work. That's something that we have to manage kind of carefully with some of our clients, because there are some clients where the designated person who's supposed to be in charge of us wants to keep us on a certain track of work. And because we've created these connections within the company, we start getting people pinging us, being like, hey, I'm having a trouble with this thing. Can you help me here? Can you help me over here? Do you have any ideas for what we can do here? How do I do this thing? And those have to be handled sometimes carefully, depending on the exact relationship with this and the contract we're on. We can't necessarily run off and do something totally else without at least some permission from whoever's in charge of what we're supposed to be doing. But it does give us those avenues to sort of branch out. And the sort of nature of e-commerce work, how there's customer support and there's fulfillment and there are all of these different areas of the company, and the different types of integrations and projects we do have us sort of interact with all those different areas, allow us to sort of get that big picture of what the company is doing and where we can be helpful. And if we help people, they come to us with more things they need help with, and that helps drive our ability to figure out what those organizations need and how we can help them.
Well, I know you in the pre-show, this is a spoiler, you said you like to try to keep things down to about an hour and wind things down. And I'm self-conscious about the fact that I tend to talk a lot. So I want to be mindful that we're coming up at an hour. And I've got, I think one of the reasons, Jared, that I enjoyed paying real close attention to your blog over the last couple of months is I've gotten more serious about blogging as such. Like, anyone listening to the show, like, if dust off your RSS reader, go subscribe to jardo.dev, Jared's site. Go subscribe to justin.searles.co. There's a handful of people. It's not just like the Ruby community or anything. More people are blogging now, even if they're hosting it on Substack or Ghost or whatever. It doesn't matter. Like, I find that blogging in general has become way, 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 like, over recently, like
yeah, huge difference great.
Between the last 6 months versus a year ago, versus even this summer, where I'm finding myself in dialogue with other blog posts really frequently. So it's a renaissance, but it's also nostalgic. And I kind of felt when I read your order driven blog post, and then again when you mentioned Growing Object Oriented Software Guided by Tests, which is a formative book for me and my journey in tests, and having had the opportunity to meet Nat Price and Steve Freeman, those were like my heroes, right? Because they unlocked a different way for me to think things. There's a certain nostalgia to this conversation, right? We're talking about Agile, we're talking about TDD, we're talking about some of these kind of fundamental processes, practices, and questions. But we're also at this moment where it's like everything is new and uncertain again because of coding agents. I'm curious, given this discussion, I guess maybe a good last question, what does AI do to the order in which you work, or the approach, or that decision-making process in the day-to-day?
The one thing I found is that it helps me gather up information to make decisions more quickly. I am not the heaviest user of AI coding tools, but I do appreciate stepping into a somewhat unfamiliar project, maybe one I haven't worked on in a while, and being able to ask the tool to look through the code base and figure out where the code around some functionality that I'm going to need to tackle is. And I can send it off on that task, continue looking at potentially other things that are better uses for human brain, and then come back and have some idea of where my starting point might be for that feature. That's where I land. How about you?
I knew you'd turn it around on me because it's only natural. It's a good closing question. And so I should have been more prepared. But I think I think, to be honest, the flip side of me being kind of a fear-based, anxiety-driven, risk-first developer is I can often succumb to that emotional response when I'm overwhelmed with a spirit of timidity and inaction, right? Like defaulting to just being feeling a little bit paralyzed or blocked up when I'm looking at what I'm looking at. And I have, over the first with Cursor and now with Claude Code, overcome that or found a new kind of coping mechanism for that reaction that's evolved in two stages. The first, I'm thinking of this kind of like live, but it makes sense, I think, to me. The first stage, the first evolution is I will give it the work. I'll say, look, I'm too chicken shit to do this right now. I know that the coding agent is relentless and will just fly at it for 45 minutes. I'm like, all right, you do it, right? Like hands off the wheel. Like, this is what I want. I can say what I want. I just can't bear to look at this code right now because I feel real stupid, and I just let it run. And I did that a bunch, and I built systems where I'd get like notified on my watch when it was done working, where it could plan out a GitHub issue, and then a different slash command would like start a branch, open a PR, and start doing that. And then I'd be able to reply in Discord at one point and be like, all right, so like fix this, like, and then it would listen to that and respond. And so like I built this whole menagerie around that. Harnessing the relentlessness of the tool. Mm-hmm. And now I've stepped back from that a little bit because I genuinely don't understand the work product well enough now that I'm doing iOS stuff that I could just like let it roam free.
Yeah.
But now what I'm finding is that if I want to be successful with Claude Code, it's actually the same lesson that I mentioned earlier. It's like, you got to get to a executable, verifiable end state ASAP. Like if Claude is working for 45 minutes and it's not running a test, and it's not, or it's not running a shell script that verifies working versus not, or it's not taking screenshots of what the website really looks like and then introspecting them, like beyond a certain point, it's just writing layer after layer of highly speculative code that's going to fall over on itself. And that's the same lesson that I had earlier, right? Which is like, you know, when you're not sure about something, drop down, write a script. And so lately, a lot of the Claude.md, like the soothsaying that one does to try to get the LLM to do what you want, a lot of mine's focused on like brass tacks, like without evidence, don't fucking speculate. I don't care. Don't say it's done if it's not done. And I'm writing like hooks to kind of combat that or to enforce that. And honestly, I think that's probably a good impulse to reinforce what I need to do to improve as a programmer.
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny note to leave on, but it turns out that that kind of ensuring that these LLM tools are getting quick feedback and getting it regularly, it works for humans, and it works, and it happens to also make these agentic tools work better.
Yeah, so just think of them as accountability partners, I guess, instead of just scary robots that might replace your job.
Yeah. All right. Well, it has been a pleasure having you on the podcast. I know that we snuck a couple plugs in there all along the way, but where can people go to follow you online?
The centralized place for everything I post is justin.searles.co. Searles is spelled like pearls, but with an S. And then if you see me on the socials or LinkedIn or any of those other sites, everything that gets posted is all auto-posted with my Posse Party app that like is still pre-release, but is syndicating all those things. So if you reply to me out there, I probably won't see it. And if I do see it, I'm going to pretend I didn't see it, because instead you should email me, because I use email just like I use RSS, because I'm an old man now, because I'm 40. So just email me, justin@searles.co, and I would love to hear from you, and I will reply.
Awesome. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you, Jared. I had a lot of fun.
I hope everyone enjoyed Justin Searles interviewing me. It makes my job really easy when I don't have to think up questions, because the guest just comes up with questions for me. So that was a super fun conversation. There was a ton of interesting ideas in there about that I think are like the start of a conversation, really, about you know, I'd love to see someone try and lay out everything that they sometimes, like every framing they use to try and make decisions about where to tackle the problem at hand. And, you know, we laid out a whole bunch of them in this interview, and I'm going to keep trying to come up with more as I work to see if I can't lay down a sort of grand unified theory of you know, how I approach problems. And that's not to say that such a thing would be, you know, actually accurate. I know the reality is much messier, but I think just the act of trying to lay it down could be really valuable. So that's something I'm going to be thinking about. This episode has been produced and edited by Mandy Moore. Now go delete some.